Hey, this is Vancouver Overcast with Mike Klassen. I'm Mike Klassen, and I'm really pleased to have you here on the line with us today. The federal election has just concluded. Some very interesting results. A lot of people saying that it was a nothing election. There were no changes. But the fact is, for regional governments and for Metro Vancouver in particular, there are going to be some changes. We saw changes in the political landscape, but we also see a lot of money moving around for transportation, housing, and other projects. So the outcome of this election was very important to the people who live here. And I have two guests today that are going to provide us with, I think, some interesting perspective on the politics and the possibilities of what will happen as a result of this election. We have a great range of subjects that we're going to be talking about. So I'd like to introduce to you my two guests. First, Lisa Dominato. Lisa is a strategic leader with 20 years experience in government administration, public policy and communications and stakeholder relations. She's worked as a public relations consultant, specializing in building social license for projects aimed at delivering benefits to the public. She was elected to Vancouver School Board in 2017 during a by-election and then elected to Vancouver City Council in 2018 and was elected as a member of the Nonpartisan Association and currently sits on council as an independent. Rob McDowell, I'm pleased to have Rob here, is a former diplomat and a passionate arts and culture supporter. Rob ran for election to Vancouver City Council in the 2014 and 2018 municipal elections and has been heavily involved in community improvement projects, both in Vancouver and abroad. He's volunteered on numerous nonprofit boards. Rob has worked abroad, covering Indochina for the Economist Group. He served in several diplomatic posts in Vietnam and in China until the year 2000. Working back here, Rob has worked as a project manager and during the COVID pandemic has decided to launch a new sustainable travel agency business that he calls Pivot Travel. And of course, Rob has been a featured host on the Vancouver Viewpoints podcast. With all that, Lisa, Rob, very pleased to have you here. Welcome. What do you think about what happened in during the federal election? Were you watching it really closely or were you just too busy or uninterested as many Canadians are? Maybe I'll start with you, Rob.
Oh, great. And thanks. Great to be here, Mike. Well, certainly I followed it with interest. I think it's always important to follow what's going on in terms of politics in this country and how it's going to impact Vancouver and what the outcome is going to be. I think it was a real interesting election. I thought it was a nail biter kind of right to the end, despite the results. I think it was fascinating and it'll be an interesting one to pick apart, look at the data.
Lisa, sort of your quick impressions of the election. I know you're a political junkie like all of us. You probably watched the daily poll results and what have you, but what were your kind of overall impressions of this interesting election campaign?
Yeah, certainly I was following it, Mike, and it was a little tricky because of the timing when it was called right in the middle of August, I have to admit, but I do think it's important to follow. I didn't feel there was a really clear ballot box question for the public in terms of this federal election. And what I did observe was particularly for Metro Vancouver is really you did see some seats change and quite a sea of red and orange across Metro Vancouver and some changes there that I think it'll be quite interesting to digest going forward.
So we'll have a chance to kind of get into the political makeup of the Metro Vancouver region, which, as you say, has seen a number of changes. But before we led up to when Prime Minister Trudeau dropped the writ back in August, what were your impressions of relations and the involvement of the federal government at that time? I know that there were a lot of big projects, a lot of big promises, but there were probably some things that didn't work quite as well as people had hoped. What were your general impressions? Lisa, I'll maybe start with you and what you thought of how things were working between the local governments here and the federal government.
Yeah, I'm happy to start there. I mean, I've personally felt a good working relationship with our local MPs and the government of the day. I've seen investments in housing and childcare, and that was big for the city. As you know, housing is top of mind for residents in Vancouver, but also as we're seeing the expansion now of the Broadway line, the focus on transportation and public transit in particular. And so from my perspective, a strong focus, but I do think there's room for improvement about how we work both with the federal government and provincial government on issues that span the political spectrum, but in terms of issues like the complexity of not only housing, but mental health and addictions, particularly as we're seeing some of the issues that we're seeing play out in the city of Vancouver, the struggles there. And I was calling for a task force that would be interprovincial, federal to address some of those issues.
Well, as somebody who had a chance to be on the Board of Governors for the City of Vancouver by being on council, you got to have a front row seat on some of those things. And I know that issues like the opioid crisis, it felt like there were some interesting things happening there, but not to the extent that perhaps maybe the public and some people were hoping for. Rob, what were your kind of takeaways pre-2021 election 44, what did you think was happening in terms of that relationship between the federal and local governments?
Well, you know, I remember when in older days, in the olden days, when Vancouver was very peripheral to what happened on the federal scene. And I think it's kind of interesting that we're more of a focus now and more of a place of interest that we weren't, you know, even a decade ago. And the fact that he was here and that he came here, he's engaged in the transit file, in the Massey Tunnel replacement file, but also housing. The fact that they're getting more interested in what's always been an issue here, which is affordability, housing affordability, and getting back into the housing market in a real way that would impact Vancouver.
Lisa, do you think you mentioned earlier on about the political makeup? So we lost, essentially, we lost four conservative seats between here and Langley. So in the Tri-Cities, Richmond, some of them were very interesting in terms of they were really quite surprising in some way. Is it possible that the federal government will just take that urban support for granted? What do you think, you know, the city of Vancouver and people living in these government-held ridings should expect in return for their support? You mentioned opioids, transportation, but you know, what are the hopes? How can the federal government be a strong supporter of change in our region?
I certainly don't think that the government's going to take it for granted, but I do think it's an opportunity, which is that the number of seats that government seats that are held here in the Lower Mainland. And I think it does present an opportunity for us to identify the issues that are top of mind here. And Rob touched on housing and housing affordability. I think childcare. So when you look at the cost to families beyond after rent or mortgage payments, childcare is probably the next biggest cost for a family. I mean, I was paying upwards of $20,000, $25,000 a year for two kids in childcare. Transportation, public transit. But I also think closely tied to the public transit conversation is seeing the federal government support municipalities in climate mitigation efforts. And it does go hand in hand with the public transit discussion. And because we're seeing increasingly that is a cost driver for not just Vancouver, and often we talk about Vancouver, but I was just at UBCM last week, and the key cost drivers are housing attainability, climate mitigation, and community safety, including not just public safety on the ground, but cyber safety. So I would like to see some efforts to address that as well.
Climate mitigation is a term that I'm starting to hear a little bit more. Can you give me an example of some of the things that were discussed at UBCM in terms of that topic?
Yeah, certainly. One of them was sea level rise. And given that we're a port city, you look at Metro Vancouver, not just Vancouver, but Richmond for as well, Delta. But that is an area that we talked about for sure. We also know the biggest emissions are buildings and then vehicles. Again, so going back to why is it important to invest in public transit and to see the federal government involved in that work, and obviously we're happy to see that investment with the Broadway line, is because it helps people get out of their cars. It gives them alternatives. And the better the public transit is, the more efficient it is, the more likely people are to use it and adopt it.
So, Rob, you get a chance to sit down with the Prime Minister for 10 minutes. You're going to give him the elevator pitch. You're a Vancouver citizen. You've been you see that the government now has a strong foothold in terms of this region. What do you think you and the city should be asking for from the federal leaders?
Well, I think as you know, and as I discussed already, the affordability issue is really important. So how we can address that is a big question, but certainly the federal government plays a pivotal role in that. And in terms of housing, that was the big file that belonged to the federal government before they got out of it in the 80s and 90s, and kind of dropped it into the province. And, it really ended up in the city's lap, and our budget is really reflects that now, and it never used to. So that would be a key consideration that I would talk to him about. Also, the growth, talking about the Port of Vancouver, the airport in Vancouver, how crucial they are to the rest of the country, and how important they are that they continue to thrive, particularly the port. And the federal government is key in that role as well. And Granville Island, it's CMHC, that's right in the heart of the city, and it's a crucial asset that we have in this that I would certainly want to talk about expanding or shifting its role.
So climate change has clearly been identified as a top priority of voters. And we also have, I think in the city of Vancouver, have made this a part of their brand, is to be very focused on environmental issues. So the question I have is, are senior levels of government who are going to make these commitments going to have to do more to incentivize other cities in the region to get on board and be very supportive? I know, Lisa, you just came back from UBCM. Climate was a top concern of the municipal leaders. But is there what more can we do right now? Because Vancouver seems to have gone out ahead. And now other cities, I think, perhaps are having to look at how ways that they can also catch up.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, a couple of things. We actually met with a number of ministers last week as part of UBCM, and one of them was the withdrawal and cancellation of provincial funding transfers that were going to municipalities, the CARP funding, to support climate mitigation. We understand that they are looking at potentially another model or framework because Vancouver was one of the biggest recipients of that funding. But I think another conversation needs to take place. We know that in terms at the city level, the biggest emitters of GHG emissions is buildings, and then after that is vehicles. One of the things that the city is considering, and I did vote in opposition to this, was a local mobility pricing model. What I think we need is a regional mobility pricing model or drive pricing model across the region. And I brought this up at Metro Vancouver yesterday as well, because I don't think that GHG emissions know municipal boundaries between Vancouver, Burnaby, Vancouver, Richmond, and that if we're going to go down the path of, because we're going to have to replace the gas tax and direct funds towards public transit, we need to have a regional approach to that. And that's one example where we can have a better coordination at the local level, at the regional level.
Rob, I know you're a citizen of the downtown Burrard Peninsula core. You're probably not driving a whole lot, except I think I know you'd like to come back and forth in the Okanagan. But what are your thoughts about the mobility pricing? It's certainly been deemed as a bit of a controversial subject, that's for sure. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's a complicated issue, obviously. But anything that allows traffic to move faster and in a more efficient manner, I think, sorry, and not faster, but more efficiently, should be welcomed. You know, right downtown, obviously, it's not a priority for us to get in our car and drive around. We tend to walk or even ride bikes. Having said that, again, I mentioned the port and I mentioned how important it is, that link that goes, that's right downtown, that's off the peninsula here. So how we address, you know, goods movement, I think is also key. So if we can do it in such a way that addresses people's needs, I think if it can be done, I think it's something that we should talk about and we should work on.
So we've been through a very difficult and continue to be in a very difficult public health emergency. And a lot of parts of the region have been hit very hard. We certainly know that things like restaurants, small businesses, a lot of things, healthcare now, have all been impacted greatly by this. Federal government now has a job of trying to help us get through the other side, get to beyond the pandemic and look at pandemic recovery. You know, Lisa, if you were to kind of repeat the last 18 months over and from the standpoint of the city, I'm sure you've probably seen things that could have been done more effectively. But let's just say that if we're kind of hit the reset button and we want to move forward, what are the things that we can do better and how can the federal government, do you think, support that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I'm certain there are things we would do differently. I do think that one of the things we learned from the pandemic is, despite how challenging it was, is that we can get to yes in a much easier fashion. Often, I think governments, all level governments, are guilty of this, is we put in place regulatory red tape, and it's an unnecessary burden to small businesses and to residents. It makes it difficult to advance things, and we get mired in the, well, that's not possible. Well, actually, the pandemic actually taught us, oh, actually, lots of things are possible if we put our minds to it and if we start to examine the frameworks we have in place. And if you look at the, a great example of that was the patios and the introduction of patios that support our restaurants and small businesses downtown and around the city. They moved very quickly to get the licenses and the permits in place for that. And again, if there's a will, there's a way. And so I think that's the lens that needs to be put on anything we do, both whether locally, but also the federal government. And I think also supporting businesses to be more mobile. We've seen a lot of businesses move online, but they didn't really have the skill set and the expertise and infrastructure to do that. So that's another area I think potentially the federal government could play a role.
I know that there's work being done on improving the permitting. You and Sarah Kirby-Young, other city councillor, sort of were drivers on that topic, and it looks like there are some positive changes on there that are coming in that front. But any sort of other thoughts on what you could have, you know, we could have done?
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the things I think about in the context you raised the permits and licenses is that we actually, fundamentally, if we address that, you will make it easier for businesses. That is, we're in the midst of trying to deal with how to make it simpler for commercial renovations, change of use. But those are areas that that staff are tackling right now. But if we had done that prior to the pandemic, even we could have made it a lot easier to do business in the city. And you raise the subject of community safety, public safety. Absolutely, that's been an issue, and we're hearing that downtown, which is why, you know, we've been calling for more support in the neighborhoods that are affected. And we see VPD has been responding now with more neighborhood patrols. I think that certainly plays a role.
Yeah, and I'm sure the VPD would love to respond to it, but everything has a price tag attached to it. And I know that when you're going to the budget, that's where a difficult conversation starts to happen. Rob, Vancouver is not the only place in Canada that it has struggled, but it certainly has been a difficult time for a lot of our sectors of our economy. Employment is a real challenge. Getting people to fill jobs has been a real challenge. What are the things that you think that the federal government can do to support this region in terms of its economy going forward?
Well, I think they're key in terms of our international linkages. I like to, again, I'm focusing on the port and the airport, but that's so important. When you think about what happened and the fact that our supply chain during the height of this kind of COVID experience didn't fall apart. I mean, there was some empty shelves because of toilet paper shortages and that type of thing. But the fact is, we all got our food. We all got, we all really didn't go hungry. We didn't want for anything necessarily. And I think that is quite amazing that the supply chain was able to adapt and react so quickly to what was going on. That's something that we really haven't, I don't think, given enough credit to all those players out there, the frontline retail workers and everybody else that's been involved in the transportation logistics. But certainly, I think the federal government has a role to play in that and making sure that the system, that the infrastructure that's in place is functioning appropriately and is up to date and is current and is ready to adapt to these kind of crises when they come up. And I think they, in a large part, they did.
So I want to maybe just talk a little bit about the political landscape as far as this federal election goes. We saw something emerge very early on in the federal campaign around the Green Party. And the Green Party, of course, the very first ever Green elected official was Adrian Carr in Vancouver City Councillor in Canada. The Green Party was able to be a coalition partner, if you'd like, in the provincial government. They elected more seats in the federal government. And then those fortunes seem to have turned. We saw seats lost in the provincial election last year. We saw it reduced down to two seats this year. One happened just as a result of a federal Liberal candidate having to step down. So I want to get your take on what you see the fortunes are for the Green Party. I realize that that you work closely with them on council, Lisa, but you know, they've been accused by some people of not really sort of standing really for what they allegedly are for, which is environmental causes. They seem to have taken some positions on council, for example, that have been not necessarily reflective of those values. Where do you think that the Green Party is going to be in terms of Canadian politics and perhaps in terms of regional politics?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Mike. I think at the federal and provincial level, there's quite a bit of rebuilding necessary there. And I think as we've seen with other parties in the past is they need to broaden their appeal. And I think particularly in light of the fact when you look at whether it be federally or provincially, the NDP, the Liberals, they have, and the Conservatives, but largely other parties have brought forward public policy proposals and platforms around climate mitigation. I think there's a recognition that climate response and climate change is not a partisan issue, just as we've dealt with other issues like mental health and addictions. And those parties have platforms. And I think during the federal election, the federal Liberals were touted as having maybe the strongest platform for that. So I think the challenge for the Green Party is to sort of renew itself and what are the issues they stand for. At the civic level, I don't think it's quite as challenging or troubling for at the local level in terms of the Green councillors who are serving on council. I think they do have a strong base here. I think climate is an important issue for residents of Vancouver. So I do think they're slightly removed from some of the federal provincial conversations.
Well, I've heard it said that the Green Party brand is potentially the one with the most resonance right now compared to what's happening, because we've seen some ups and downs with some of the other parties. We'll maybe talk about Vision Vancouver and recent news about them in a moment. Rob, do you think that the Green Party has a strong future, or do you think they really need to maybe go back to the drawing board a little bit?
I think the whole problem with any sort of advocacy sort of group or activist sort of group, it's always a challenge when you get in and you have to focus on governance. Right. And I think that's such a difficult shift for any sort of organization. And I think we see it with the Greens as well. I'm a bit harsher on the Greens. I consider them a populist type of party, and I don't see them as being very pragmatic, to be honest. I think they're weighed down by a lot of their historical weight, and their branding is super strong, but unfortunately, it kind of hinders them from doing sometimes the right thing, or the best thing to provide the best outcomes. So I'm more of a green skeptic than anything else. I think there's a generational issue that they have as well with the baby boomers who were in charge, reflected by Adrian Carr, having more of, you know, Sierra Club sort of background. And then the newer generation, maybe Mike, maybe Pete, who reflect different values and more social justice focus. And that, I think there's an inherent clash there. And so it'll be interesting how they get through that generational shift.
Rob, maybe since we're talking about the overall sort of political makeup of the region, there's a lot of blue voters, there's a lot of conservative voters in our city. And clearly, those voters decided not to to come out in the numbers needed to try and elect people. We saw some losses that happened. It seems to me that the conservative movement, whatever that is, and it seems to be shifting even in Canada today, has really struggled with where it wants to be in terms of urban voters. If you were going to sit down and talk to your conservative friends and have that conversation, what should they be thinking about, do you think, as people who want to represent urban ridings? Any kind of ideas on that front?
Well, I think the problem that exists is sort of this social conservatism that doesn't jive well with urban values in Canada today. And I think any conservative sort of movement or party has to figure out how to deal with that. Whether they exclude them from their movement or whether they bring them into the fold and address those, you know, that type of audience in a palatable way for voters. I think that's the challenge, and how you can, I don't think any conservative movement is ever going to make inroads in Vancouver without addressing how, you know, the fact that they would limit or how they would address sort of the socially conservative aspects of their movement, which is a concern, I think rightly so, for a lot of people here.
It's a very interesting comment, because we have social conservative people here. We have church groups. We have other you know, pockets of support for that more social conservative politics in urban settings. But the risk of any political organization is to be seen as just representing ex-urban or rural voters. I mean, you're really not going to get very far if you can't accommodate the interests and concerns of urban centers.
Yeah, and I think the thing that's really changed too is just the role of social media, and storytelling is more important with politics, and emotional storytelling is really resonates with people now, as opposed to sort of more practical aspects of politics. So, and the whole concept of outrage and instant outrage, you know, in social media, is quick to jump on anything that sticks out. And social conservatism is certainly affected by that.
Lisa, you want to give us your take on what you would sort of tell a member of parliament running for the Conservatives here, what you think they should be thinking about? I mean, not that they, I'm sure if anybody plans to run in a future federal election as a Conservative candidate, they must be asking themselves, hey, I can be a Conservative, but I can also be somebody who really is vested in my city community. What, you know, what kind of priorities do you think they should be focusing on? What would be your thoughts for them?
Well, a couple of things. You know, I was listening to Robin, and actually one of the first things that came to mind for me as well was that I think reconciling, the Conservative Party needs to reconcile the issues around that social conservatism, particularly when you consider our urban centers are very diverse and dynamic. And I think that is an issue they need to address. I think that the Conservatives lost some votes to the PPC, the rise of that party in Canada. I think, you know, we talked earlier about parties like the Green Party having to broaden their appeal. I think similarly, I, once stage, it was a couple of years ago, where the Conservative Party was talking about they weren't recognizing climate change. I think it was one of the motions that came, the resolutions that came to the floor in their convention. But I do think they need to reconcile some of these issues, and particularly the way I look at voters and residents and the public is that they're multidimensional. And so while there are ballot box issues or issues that people vote on because there's a specific issue of concern to them, people also are looking to what are the values that are espoused by an organization, whether it's a political party, a civic organization. And so I think Rob made a good point there about how does the Conservative Party reconcile those issues, particularly with urban voters.
Well, we'll see, because again, I think it has been a real challenge. And I know that we've got, for example, a BC Liberal leadership campaign going on right now. We're going to be looking at leaders who are also have the same quest of trying to find a foundation, a foothold in cities that have progressively gone more to the NDP in the last couple of elections. But again, it's about how do we bridge those concerns of city dwellers with those of these conservative and center right political organizations. Anyway, I know that we won't be able to sort of resolve or solve that in this conversation, but it's definitely one that I find really interesting, and it has real implications for future elections in this region. The Vancouver at times feels like it has been struggling. It's been struggling a little bit. There's a grumbling that goes on there, and the public is restless, and so they're going to be asking for some change out of this election. I think they rightly would expect some change. So if you're going to sit down with a local MP and say, look, here are the things that we can work on together, and we think that the public are really in favor of, what are the top two things that you think those members of parliament should be focusing on, the ones that are representing Vancouver riding specifically? Rob, maybe I'll start there with you.
Well, I want to address what you were saying, because I think the outcome of this election is that people completely did not expect any change or anything. The fact that we ended up with basically the same seat count as going into the election, I think shows that people just want stability and calm and nothing new or different than what's been happening. I think there's a real anxiety out there in regards to big movements and big changes. And, even changing the government was, I think, off the table for just about everybody. So I just wanted to address that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you that it was a status quo from that mm-hmm. standpoint. I wonder though that it didn't seem like that it was all apple pie during this election. There was a lot of
not at all. No.
And a lot of
I think someone said people who are normal were angry, and people who are angry, normally angry, were completely crazy. And I think that's just a sign of our times right now. It's just people want stability and want a system they can rely on. This CERB, that's, I think, one of the reasons CERB was so popular as a policy brought in by the federal government. It just provided that sort of, okay, we can all just kind of try and relax, even though nobody's in the mood to relax right now. But I would just talk about housing. Going back to your question, housing and affordability, I think any way they can address those two issues, and of course they're intertwined, is a way... would be my advice from the federal level. Yeah, Lisa, federal policies that push that.
So, housing the same thing that you would press with members of parliament, Lisa?
A couple of things. So, I'll tackle that one as well. It's one thing. Certainly, top of mind would be housing, but I would combine it with housing and homelessness. You've got two different issues going on. You've got housing attainability and affordability. So people looking for a range of housing options that's going to meet their needs and their incomes, that ties into the affordability. But we also have a growing homelessness issue. It's not just Vancouver, we know that. And the plight of individuals who are falling through the cracks. And so I that would be definitely part of the conversation. And The other, there's a couple of things, but the other one I want to hone in on, because I think that it's also increasingly pronounced in Vancouver, is the concerns around the public health concerns around mental health and addictions. We declared an opiate overdose crisis in 2016 as a province. And I think if you ask most people, they don't feel it's getting better. They feel it's getting worse. There's a whole bunch of reasons why. The pandemic definitely exacerbated things around homelessness, but also around tainted drug supply, which has continued. But I would want to be, and I did call for this at council. I called for a provincial, federal civic task force to bring together the experts that we need to turn this ship, just as we did with the pandemic. The pandemic was identified. We've got to, everybody's got to fall in line. We've got to have a strategy and a plan and look at where we are today. It's not perfect. We still have some issues. We've got a new variant, but there was a recognition that we couldn't just sit idly by and do nothing, that we needed to mobilize all the different levels of government to address the pandemic. I would be bending the ear of our local MPs, and I intend to, don't worry, around this very issue, but on mental health and addictions, because it's playing into livability of the city. It's tying into concerns around community safety. And it is a public health issue. We have people who are falling through the cracks. And just, sorry, linking this back, Mike, to the provincial discussions, we've been calling for urban mayors and councillors for a model of complex care housing, and the feds could play a role in this. And this is a model of housing that goes beyond our supportive housing, where we actually can reach the individuals who are falling through the cracks. These are individuals who may have brain trauma, they may have had suffered multiple overdoses, but they are on our streets, and they're not getting the type of care they need. They're not getting it in SROs. They're not getting it in supportive housing. And this is something that we talked to provincial ministers about last week. How do we advance a model like that? And so those are a couple of things. We talked earlier about transportation, because I think public transit is critical going forward. And we also need to talk about the economy, because there are key players in trade and immigration. And so.
Rob, you said that people wanted that stability, that status quo. I would say that Lisa is almost suggesting just the opposite, that we really do need to see change, particularly on mental health and addictions. The opioid crisis is completely unacceptable. And, you know, I mean, I realize that our members of parliament work hard, our elected officials work hard, but boy, they got to roll up their sleeves on this one. Do you agree on that?
I mean, I would agree, but again, it's so centralized. The issue, you know, if we look at downtown east side, that's one riding. I guess it overlaps on another riding. So we've centralized all the major issues into two ridings. Is there really an incentive for, I'm being very cynical here, but is there really an incentive for other MPs to focus on this issue when it's not in their own riding? Is there an issue for the province when we know that those people are coming from all over the province, all over the country, and they're all going through this experience there, which for me seems like the ultimate trauma, you know, community-based trauma. But I guess what I'm concerned about is there the real incentive? We haven't seen it yet. And is there the true incentive to deal with this problem on a regional basis, a provincial basis, a federal basis? I don't know if there is. They know it's there. They just want to keep it there.
It speaks to how decisions and are made in government and how power works in this country. I think we need to. This has to be something that burns inside the Prime Minister and other key members of cabinet. They have to really get activate on this one, because this challenge is not just, even though you do say that the visible experience of the downtown east side and parts of Vancouver, but we also know there are parts of Surrey, parts of the Fraser Valley, the overwhelming majority of people are dying in their homes by themselves. And that's happening in all communities. It's happening on the west side. It's happening on the east side. Anyway, so just maybe on a little bit of a lighter note, let's kind of just round out, be talking about just Vancouver politics. I wanted to just talk about a story that came out this week that Vision Vancouver, who, let's face it, Vision Vancouver, not many of us on this call were terribly supportive of that organization when they governed, have been having a few bumps. They clearly were kind of wiped out and left outside of government during the 2018 election. They're trying to go through some kind of a revival themselves right now, but they hit a bit of a bump in the road in that the Vancouver District Labor Council, who traditionally have been an important vehicle for center and left-wing councillors and park board and school board, have said, we're not going to be supporting Vision. So, I don't think we're going to cry a lot of tears about that necessarily, but it does tell you that they're making some choices and changes are going to be coming in terms of Vancouver politics in the future. What's your sort of give us your inside baseball and what you think this announcement by the VDLC and the troubles that Vision faced means? Maybe I'll start with you, Rob.
I always think it's interesting how VDLC and their endorsement process is so kind of overlooked by a lot of people and seem to be quite acceptable. We know that during Vision's time, you know, Jeff Mays was in there making deals. I think there were tapes of the conversation and how it worked, I think. But I think their role chiefly is ensuring that the left vote is not as split as it could be. And they do a good job at that, limiting the candidates that come forward. But I think we sometimes overstate their power in terms of their endorsement, the actual endorsement when it comes to the ballot box. And we can see that in the past when they do endorse candidates, it really doesn't reflect in the outcomes at the ballot box. With 71 council candidates running, you know, the people that they necessarily endorse, it's not really impacted. But of course, candidates are always jockeying for the endorsement and they all want to, you know, it's super important for any candidate to have that sort of wind at the back, at your back, as opposed to, and it's that natural competitive nature of politics and politicians. But I do think we overstate the VDLC's power at the ballot box.
Lisa, I'm not sure if you're sitting by your phone waiting for the VDLC endorsement yourself, but it was interesting that that there were changes to the election legislation in BC that were announced. I think it was late last year that will have implications for the 2022 election. Including providing any support, either in kind or directly. So it sounds like from recent reports, the DLC are thinking that the rules haven't changed. What's your impression and what's your understanding of how we can have these third party groups involved in essentially working on the ground in elections?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Mike, because when I was reading the article this week about the VDLC and their role, it seemed very clear that they do have intentions to be involved as a third party in the upcoming civic election. And I think the whole point of the reforms that were made just before I ran in for the council election was to deal with the role of large unions and corporations in influencing our elections. And so what I'd be concerned about is how are we ensuring that those third parties are accounted for in terms of the hours that are put in, the money that's going into it. There has to be a level playing field in all of this. And we have to be playing by the same rules. And so when I read that, you know, I immediately jumped out at me as, well, how are they going to be involved? And is that going to be accounted for under the new rules? And so I think that's something we need to be paying attention to, all of us, both, as candidates and as civic party, civic organizations.
Well, we'll see. We're just about 12 months away from a municipal election, and things are going to be interesting, but I expect they'll start to heat up now because this federal election, which many people thought was coming for a long time, was going to take up a lot of the attention span, and now that it's done, it will probably change the focus of where we're going in the city and across the region. I want to thank you both very much for coming on the podcast. I'm still trying to get my head around doing this on a both an audio and video stream, but it really is great to hear your perspectives. And I realize that this is a still pretty fresh in terms of our minds in terms of election, but there's a lot of work to come in terms of how the new government, we'll have to wait to see what the cabinet announcements are and what the mandate letters look like in terms of and how those may affect Metro Vancouver as well. So my guests have been Lisa Dominato, a city councillor in Vancouver, and Rob McDowell. And I just want to remind you all to visit my new Patreon page at patreon.com/overcastYVR. And if you go to www.overcastYVR, you'll be able to find all of the previous episodes of the Vancouver Overcast with Mike Klassen podcast. All the best. Thank you for listening. And thanks to my guest. Have a great day.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.